So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Eric Hansen, who is CTO and founder of SiteSpect. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Hi, Adrian. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, Eric, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a little bit about you and a bit about the work that you do and the work that SiteSpect does?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So, really, since the early 90s, I've been a product guy, an engineer, and an entrepreneur, really all around the digital space and the early incept of the internet. Currently, as you said, I'm founder and CTO of SiteSpect. SiteSpect was founded in 2004 and actually grew out of an evolution of the previous company that I started called World Machine, which in the mid-90s and the dot-com era was really one of the first consulting and engineering firms focused specifically on building out those first-generation e-commerce and publishing sites.
Right.
So I had a lot of opportunity in that time to work with companies that were traditional brands that were trying to figure out how to get into digital and take advantage of what was then the World Wide Web and the new internet, and starting out with what you would look back on fondly now and say, oh, brochureware websites,
right?
But figuring out how to make those interactive, add transaction capabilities. And what that inevitably led to was how do you create a compelling, usable, persuasive, effective customer experience online? And after doing that bespoke so many times with various clients, we came up with the idea that wouldn't it be great if we could actually try different versions of a customer experience as an experiment, a controlled experiment, and learn based on actual end user behavior, what worked and what didn't.
Right.
And essentially built a tool, a platform to do large scale experimentation, targeting and personalization, specifically for digital, which, as you know, now is not just desktop, but includes mobile and other channels. And we commercialized that. And that essentially was the inception of SiteSpect. And that's what I'm working on today.
Fantastic. Now, one of the reasons I'm really interested in, all things kind of customer experience and how kind of what firms can do to improve that and so on and so forth. And we were talking offline and you were telling me about how you're really excited about the potential of AI for customer experience and, how it can help improve it, make it easier, make it more effective and so on and so forth. But can you tell me a little bit about why you're so excited in terms of the potential?
Sure. I think a couple of different reasons. First, and obviously, I'm in the line of business of helping, large brands make their digital presence better, more effective, and compete online. And artificial intelligence and personalization, machine learning, whichever term or terms you like, are certainly a key trend and a key part of that to be able to scale and help people navigate what is increasingly a complex set of options, products, services, things that they could buy that they may want to steer away from, and just trying to reduce that overall friction. That's certainly from a commercial and a business standpoint, a big part of why I'm excited is just evolution and the promise of always doing better and hopefully learning from what worked and what didn't and, just evolving. But the other reason I'm excited is because like you and probably, many, if not all other folks that are listening to this podcast, I'm a customer too. A lot of time online, whether it's buying a gift or, refilling some household staples, that we consume and we need to reorder or booking a trip or a flight or whatever. I want to have a good experience. I want to ideally find the product service solution that I need and then conduct a transaction or at least start on that relationship with a brand. And for me, it's not so much about saving time as it is wanting to make sure that I've made the best choice possible. I don't think it's a disincentive to, you know, spend more time doing research or reading or looking at different options. But I think, you know, the consumers have this instinctive fear of making the wrong choice. And part of, you know, AI and recommendations and personalizations, you know, as it's known really in the commercial, you know, e-commerce space, is trying to help people make better choices, be better informed as they're doing it, reduce friction, reduce that sense of risk. And all of that helps us both in business and in our personal lives, as, you know, really the, you know, online is predominantly the channel through which we're making our purchases these days.
Right. That's brilliant. However, the kind of other thing that you kind of said earlier, which really kind of like sort of stood out to me, was this, you also kind of went on to say that, but given all this kind of the potential of AI and how it can help improve customer experience, you also went on to say that brands should also proceed with kind of caution. I mean, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, we're talking about, I guess, the abundance of options, bells and whistles, and what I might call the kitchen sink approach,
right,
to the digital, I would even say the user experience, you know, what you see, whether it's on your desktop or your phone, or, you know, even if you're making a phone call to a help desk or a customer service center, you know, just being presented with too many different options, and, you know, you just know immediately that's not what you're looking for.
Right.
And I think when you layer in, you know, here's a sort of basic generic one size fits all experience, and then you try to improve that by getting smarter, you know, you just need to be careful about doing that in a way that, you know, you're adding clarity, and guiding the end user, and not literally just putting additional stuff on the table that, you know, has to be understood, processed mentally, and overcome as, you know, yet another feature or function, that is, you know, while trying to simplify a process, is at the same time making it harder, because you're adding complexity or instrumentation,
right,
to the user experience. I think that's really one of the main things that I see, that we see in, you know, in our customer base is, you know, it's kind of like whatever happened to less is more.
Right.
You know, it used to be, you know, for those of us old enough to remember, you know, if you wanted to go out and buy an appliance, you know, you'd go to a store and there'd be for that specific type of appliance that you wanted, there might be two or three brands. And, you know, someone was there typically in the, you know, brick and mortar retail setting to help you with selections and understand the differentiation between the products. Mm-hmm. And the reason they only carry two or three is because if they carried every single possible product from every manufacturer, there'd be very little differentiation in feature or price.
Mm-hmm.
Now, online, of course, you go to any, you know, mass merchandising e-commerce site, and you really can pretty much buy any model of any product, of any appliance or any other product category. And I think that that is a form of more options are good, but at the same time, more options are harder to select from. And so, you know, there's sort of the, you know, that double-edged sword of giving more selection while at the same time helping people to reduce the options and ultimately make a purchase.
Yeah.
Because if there's too many options and they all seem pretty similar, I may say, you know, I'm going to pick this up another day.
Yeah.
And it may not be with that same site.
Yeah.
Or brand that I started on. So, yeah, so I think that there's a balance there.
I think it's interesting because that reminds me of, I think it was a study that was done by, I think the lady's name is called Susan Schwartz, I think. And she wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice. And one of the central kind of like studies that she did as part of that was looking at a jam and preserve company, and they had about 33 different varieties of different flavors, types of jams and preserves. And they did this kind of like study where they found that if they reduced the choice, the number of choices that customers had, because we end up getting into this situation of choice fatigue in many ways. And when we get into fatigue, it sort of becomes confusing and we decide not to choose. And she found that actually if you reduce the choice, they actually boosted their sales by about 30-35%. So, I mean, it's fascinating. It's like you say, it's like sometimes what, you know, we get caught up in the bells and whistles and doing what we think is kind of right and adding more choice, but actually can be counterproductive.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, when you said, why am I excited about AI and, you know, machine learning and personalization, I'm quick to point out that two vantage points that I have, which is, you know, one from the, you know, from the brand's perspective, which is, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could add this, you know, capability to the website? You know, our competitor just added this, or, you know, being sold these different, you know, new capabilities I can bolt into my website from these different vendors. And there's just this temptation that since so much budget is being put for these brands online, that they should just add more stuff.
Yeah.
But from the other perspective, you know that's going to take time, effort, and really strategy to sort out so that it's actually simplifying in a measurably better way rather than, you know, simply complicating. I mean, it's, you know, you don't want to have a customer experience that's akin to, you know, getting into the cockpit of an F-16 where there's just a million dials and gauges and you just don't even know where to begin.
Sure.
You don't want users to feel like they have to be trained to interact with your website or your mobile app.
Yeah. The other thing that kind of you also kind of mentioned is, and I think this is a thing that a lot of people have been talking about in terms of caution and risk around AI, and is how we've also got to understand that these systems, these algorithms and the data sets and the inferences that are made from the data and things, they can actually start developing kind of biases. I mean, have you seen that? And right. What sort of kind of biases are you seeing kind of like playing kind of out?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every once in a while there's a news story about, you know, someone who, you know, went to a, you know, large, you know, mass merchandising website and received a recommendation for something that seemed really off from the product that they're reviewing. You know, people that viewed this also viewed that, people that bought this also bought that, et cetera. And, you know, unfortunately, this is just the, you know, the way the algorithms work, and you know, personalization in particular, the cross-seller recommendation strategies, you know, always have some type of, you know, manual override that can apply, you know, just human judgment against
right.
what would otherwise be, you know, purely algorithmically developed sets of you know, inferences and just product recommendations. So that tends to be the type that I think I see, you know, most often, and you might see in the news. And you know, at the end of the day, the ability to, you know, I'm talking a lot about recommendations just because in the e-commerce space, that is one of the main applications, you know, for types of innovations.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, If I bought this, so here's the right set of batteries, here's the right, you know, case or some other accessories or whatever. So it all makes sense, but it's only as good as the underlying product and, you know, attribute data.
Sure.
Which in a lot of cases is really still not that granular. You know, product manufacturers are, you know, really upping their game in terms of specs and dimensions and making it so that, you know, you can compare multiple products to each other on an apples to apples basis. You know, but I think number one, the data is still not thorough across different manufacturers. It's also not thorough and consistent across product categories. And then of course, you know, the final element is what do humans actually do when they're interacting with product information or product details. And, you know, there are ways that you can game the system. There are ways that erroneous recommendations You see something, you're going to click on it, and it's, oh, that's a terrible recommendation. But the fact that you clicked on it is still a cue to the algorithm that, oh, well, we should continue to show this product because, you know, clearly there's some level of engagement, because when people see product A, they're also clicking on a link to product B.
Right.
So there is a lot of inherent bias just in how these mechanics work. And, you know, to really do it well, again, measurably well, it still does require, you know, human intervention, review of data, and, you know, different approaches, products, as you know, third party products that can be bolted into websites to do this, as well as just homegrown solutions.
Yeah,
they all need care and feeding and evolution over time to make sure that they are accurate and that these sorts of biases can be sniffed out.
The interestingly enough, the I was speaking to a chap by the name of Rob Walker from Pega a couple months ago, and he characterized the different types of kind of AI that we're starting to see. And he talked about sort of opaque and transparent AI, where transparent is something that is easily auditable and opaque isn't, and how there's all these we've got to be able to manage the quality and almost the ethics of their outputs. I mean, what have you seen, or what are you seeing, or what are you recommending to your clients on the assumption that you agree, and it sounds like you do? What are you seeing as best practices in terms of managing some of that, those sort of dimensions, and the kind of the QA, I guess, in many ways, kind of that sits around a lot of this?
So QA, quality assurance, is a good keyword to throw into this conversation, because again, I think, you know, it's still very early days, and you know, you do need that human oversight, as we've been talking about. Transparent versus opaque is an interesting sort of discussion point. And you know, with what we do, with what SiteSpec does, you know, a common use case is a company is going to invest in a personalization strategy, and there are a whole bunch of different questions that you want to be able to answer and validate, was this the right strategy or choice or not? Mm-hmm. And one of the broadest ones is, you know, to personalize or not to personalize.
Right.
And, you know, to personalize, depending on the company and the brand, and whether they're selling, you know, office supplies or airline tickets, you know, you're going to use different types of data to form those recommendations, those elements that are personalized. It may be product data, it may be purchase history, or it may be things like your location, your geolocation. It may be the cell phone model that you use and the cell phone carrier that you use.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can see how this really runs the gamut of, you know, generic product information, you know, people that like this also like that. On the other hand, it's taking personal information and using that as, even if it's anonymous, still, you know, knowing where geographically you're located, that's, you know, that's personal information.
Sure.
And when that comes into the mix, the algorithm, the premise is we can give you a better recommendation if we know more about you. The downside is you may give me, if I think or I'm expecting a really good recommendation because I've just logged in, to the experience. Now you have all my historical data, and you miss and you recommend something, or you, change my experience in a way that's supposed to be better, and you miss and it's actually worse or it's wrong, you know, then I think that's going to stand out much more starkly than even if it was a non-personalized experience. So,
sure.
You know, getting back to your point, you know, in the experimentation sense, you know, we generally don't want to say, hey, you're seeing a personalized experience, or hey, you're not seeing a personalized experience. You
know,
we want it to be sort of this blind experiment where, you know, purely what you see and then what you do as a result, you know, we can establish cause and effect. But when you get into the ethical question, you know, you could argue that, you know, once you decide on a strategy and you're executing that strategy, if there are things like you're going to be personalizing the experience based on, you know, at minimum these three things and potentially any other information, you know, that is something that, you know, we would recommend that, you know, customers put in some type of a statement that is available, so that it is at least transparent, it is stated, depending on, you know, where you're doing business in the world, particularly in Europe, you know, safe harbor and, you know, EU privacy and cookie laws, you know, these things actually are put in your face. In the US, they really are not, you know, but I think as, again, as these elements to customer and user experience, you know, continue to evolve, there probably is going to be broader legislation and regulation in the U.S. where you're going to have to start to disclose these things. And then I think, again, it's brands are going to have to think more carefully about, you know, what elements are they using from personal history to build the experience and to just be open about those. The ad industry has been doing this for many years. And I think, you know, site-side personalization is going to need to catch up.
And I mean, but it seems to be, I mean, just thinking about the quantum of the challenge, you know, when you talk about QA, you talk about ethics, implications, some of the harnessing some of the potential and managing some of the, you know, the risks. I mean, if you're, particularly if you're talking about a popular e-commerce site, that might be dealing with thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of transactions a day. I mean, when you, and you want this oversight, I mean, kind of, I'm just trying to think about, that seems like, I'm just trying to think about how that oversight is going to work if you have a human intervention. I mean, how, what are you recommending for your clients? Because they probably don't want to kind of have an army of people going, yes, no, yes, no, you know.
No, they don't.
So how does it work in practice?
I think there's a couple of dimensions to it. So the day-to-day run-of-the-mill stuff, you know, should be all about looking at metrics and using experimentation. And experimentation does not mean, you know, that you are always trying new stuff, although that's what it ought to be. But specifically for your question, you know, if 95% of users are getting a personalized experience and 5% at random are not, then you have a way to compare the efficacy of that approach versus not using the approach. So, you know, a big part of what SiteSpec does is, again, helping, you know, customers experiment with and evolve any element of their site. And so if that's the algorithm or an element of the algorithm that is generating, you know, personalized content, then you do have a base on which to continue to sort of, you know, monitor what the baseline is, which is your control group, and, and what is in theory supposed to be the better group. So that's sort of broad stroke that you would continue to keep an eye on as you make changes to, you know, again, to the algorithms. And then on a specific, you know, product or SKU basis or recommendation, you know, again, it's just, it's granularity of data and it's being able to have control limits about what the expected conversion rate and engagement rate and different business KPIs are, and just know when something is veering off and being able to address that. So that's sort of the broad method. In terms of individual, you know, this, when I viewed this product, I got really a set of, you know, lousy recommendations. You know, that's voice of customer, right? You have to be able to, you know, listen to surveys, listen to social media. I mean, the stuff, you know, I won't go through, you know, news history, but if you look at, you know, studies or even just sensationalized, you know, stories that have been written about over the years, it's usually, you know, someone, you know, viewed this book and was recommended that video, and there was something like offensive about it, and people will start going to social media because it's in, you know, again, it's something that's sensationalized. So I think that's another form of a voice of customer, and hopefully that's not how the singular way that a brand finds out that they've got a problem that they need to resolve is by hearing about it, you know, tweeted out to, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of followers. But again, I think this insight can come from anywhere. And if you're a mass merchandiser and you're carrying hundreds of thousands, if not millions of products, and you have, you know, 2, 3, 5 million visitors per day on your website, it is really difficult to scale all that.
Yeah.
And the only way, again, is leveraging the data and having systems in place to surface aberrations to what would otherwise be, you know, fairly tight ranges of expected behavior.
Okay. So, thank you. I mean, that makes, you know, that makes a lot of sense, and kind of thank you for sort of explaining kind of some of that. But Eric, can you, I mean, I know you work with some panoply of kind of like big brands and things, and many of which, right, obviously, because they're working kind of with you, they will be, you know, getting stuck in with the use of kind of AI and trying to improve their experience and kind of in personalization and stuff. Can you give me a couple of examples of brands that you that you're working with that are getting ahead of this, the whole CX and personalization and AI sort of, you know, sort of trend, and you know what they're doing and how is it working kind of for them?
Yeah, the example I would give is about Staples. Staples is a, I think, the world's largest B2B retailer for office supplies, mm-hmm, and electronics and a number of other things. You know, very, very well known in the U.S. And I believe in Europe. Yes. They're in 29 different countries. So again, pretty big global brand. We've been working with Staples for a bunch of years, and, you know, again, experimentation, personalization. But on the topic of your question, you know, a recent set of significant wins for them was really identifying how to best incorporate tailored recommendations. So, you know, personalized, you know, recommendations for products or refills on products that you previously bought, and different deals and promotions that are going to be relevant to you, mm-hmm, integrating those specifically under their homepage. Like many brands, the homepage is the most singular, you know, most viewed page, because that's where people start their journey in the brand. And for Staples, some of the sort of headline numbers, you know, that came out of this set of experiments and, you know, really optimization effort was that they significantly improved engagement, you know, which they measure as it's a compound of a number of different user experience metrics, but they improved their engagement by 114%.
Wow. Okay.
So really very significant lift there. And then also boosted conversion. So percentage of, you know, visitors who make a transaction, a purchase, increased their overall conversions by 15%. Which is, you know, material and very significant when you look at the scale of their website and the volume that they do.
Perfect.
So, you know, for that's, you know, one of a number of examples. But again, you know, really impactful when you look at, you know, the what they're trying to focus on in terms of a simple and efficient and clean user experience, mm-hmm, you know, but also, as we talked about, layering in some of these bells and whistles that make it a better user experience, more relevant, persuasive, and not just adding stuff that the user has to then, you know, wade through and figure out. So it's almost like personalization, but it's subtle enough and it's so on spot that it just doesn't seem abnormal. It seems very natural and fluid, and that's really working well for them.
Excellent. So, I mean, Eric, that sounds brilliant. I mean, but if I was to say to you, if one of our listeners was an exec or a leader in, say, in an e-commerce kind of business, and they were saying, yeah, you know what, our personalization isn't that great, it's a bit clunky, I like the sound of kind of what you're talking about, this kind of layering in something which is a bit more smooth, feels a bit more seamless, a bit more, makes more sense. What should they do? Where should they start with this? Because it's not just just going to be a plug and play sort of thing, is it?
Correct. yeah, it's not going to be. There needs to be a personalized engine to learn about personalization. Because if you do a web search, you know, you're going to find just tons and tons of content. You know, other blogs, podcasts, articles. You know, some of which are academic and, you know, journals and whatnot, yeah. You know, Harvard Business Review, trade shows, et cetera, et cetera. So really all the obvious places, some of them may be less obvious for your readers that I would suggest, still exploring is there is actually a lot being done around all these fields. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm just lumping AI, machine learning, personalization together, even though they all have slightly different connotations. But there's a ton of open source projects for software and code, many of which can be at least read about and studied without having to, start installing software and, cracking open your computer science books from college.
Right.
But that's one that I think will, if you spent an hour looking through, even a couple of different open source projects and all the major brands, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, they have, in some cases developed and in other cases acquired, code and software that they have then open sourced. Very well documented, a lot of activity, around those. And that I think is a good learning experience, even if, ultimately as a commercial business, you're going to go out and potentially, work with another firm, whether SiteSpec or someone else, mm-hmm. That's going to layer on, professional services and strategy and what else may be needed. But I think that's a really good way to get a better rounded education around what's available, the state of the art, what projects and approaches are, sort of growing in momentum and popularity, and what are some that may be a bit dated at this point.
So it seems like, Gary, what you're saying is, ladies and gentlemen, before you commission or start putting together investment proposals for next year, you got to go back to open source school.
Well, I just think that's a generally a honest and relatively non-commercial way to get educated.
Yeah, of course.
Even if you're going to go out and spend money, whether you take open source and build on it, you may spend more money that way, but have additional customization flexibility. Or again, you work with a firm or some combination of the two.
Yeah.
I just think, the educated buyer, the educated, businessman, businesswoman is going to be the most effective.
Perfect. So, Eric, is there anything else that you'd like to add that we've kind of missed out before I ask you my final two questions that I always ask at the end of these interviews?
Yeah. I mean, I just reiterate the notion that, there's a lot here that's new. There's a lot of stuff that's not new, that's old. But when it comes to your specific brand and your specific customer base and all the things that make them unique, there is no one size fits all solution mm-hmm. for you as a brand and, of course, also for your customers. So it's just to reinforce the notion of experimentation is, the idea that you can try things out and find out what's best, but at the same time, try things out and find out what is ineffective mm-hmm. or actually harms the user experience. That's really the key to all of it. Mm-hmm. If you have a mindset and a strategy of experimentation, then you can really try anything, and you know that you will have a built-in mechanism to only be improving in a positive direction. Evolving in a positive direction, and not rolling out things that may seem like, cool, shiny objects, but, without realizing it, you're going to actually make your user experience worse. You don't want that. So just treat everything like an experiment, learn, improve, and grow from there.
Perfect. Thank you. Now, Eric, so this brings me to my final two questions. And the first one is based around, so I wrote a book last year called How to Wow, and it was just a whole collection of a whole bunch of insights and ideas and sort of strategies around how people, to inspire people to that there's no, as you said before, no one way to improve your customer experience. But what I've been doing since its publication sort of last year is asking everybody on the podcast interviews is, what does wow service or experience mean to you?
Yeah. I look at it probably in two ways. One is, reactive, and the other is proactive. Reactive would be, I was on a flight. It was delayed, maybe taking off and landing, the Wi-Fi didn't work, the movies broke, whatever it is. And after I land, I get a call or an email or something personalized again for me, you know, based on my experience. And it's, you know, some way to re-engage and invite my feedback and maybe even just for me to vent. Mm-hmm. I think that's a, you know, that is an example of a good experience based on a bad experience, right? But it's trying to have a dialogue and, you know, treat what may have admittedly been a bad outcome, like it's an ongoing relationship that I have with that brand and that the brand cares, and is reaching out to me to, you know, get my take on it. And at the same time, acknowledge that there was a problem. I think that is an example, you know, not uncommon, but also not universal.
Sure.
Of sort of reactive. And then the other might be proactive. And, you know, I probably don't have as many good examples here, but I'll give you one, which is a particular retailer that I think I've, you know, bought from maybe 3 or 4 times over 10 years. And every once in a blue moon, you know, every like 18 or 24 months, I'll literally get a call from a, you know, from a rep from this retailer saying, hey, we haven't heard from you in a while. You know, just real quick, you know, touch base, make sure everything's okay. You know, we've got a few promos going, this and that. You know, it might be a 30-second conversation, but it always catches me off guard and it surprises me. And it's so folksy and, again, personalized specifically to me, that, again, since I haven't bought from these guys, you know, really more than that many, it's a music retailer, so I don't have to buy musical gear all that often. But it always catches me by surprise and it's something that I remember. And if I need to buy a product in that category, that's where I'm going back to. So that would be an example of a proactive one. You know, and again, these things just, they're not universal, so they stick out right now. And those would be sort of the two examples that come to mind.
Perfect. Thank you. So that brings me to my final question. And it's one that I always like to ask at the end of these interviews, Eric. And the question is this.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
that I haven't already? Yeah, you know, not shamelessly, but yeah, I would just encourage folks to check us out on the web, www.sitespect.com. We have lots of content that is intended to be, you know, educational and, you know, informative and not solely commercial in nature. And those are resources that we create simply to educate the market, and again, to be honest and fair, mm-hmm. About what these capabilities bring to the digital business strategy. And I encourage people to look at those and others as well.
Perfect. Eric, I'll make sure we get all that kind of linked up. And so give you and the folks at SiteSpect and the work that you're doing a big shout out when this goes live. But just wanted to say, thank you for your time and sharing your insight and experience today. That's been great.
Yeah, you bet. Likewise. Thank you.